Welcome to this WERU special. I'm Jim Campbell. In anticipation of the 2011 Camden Conference, to be held February 18th to 20th, 2011, on today's program, we'll feature highlight presentations from the 2010 Camden Conference, whose theme was Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Crossroads of Conflict. We'll hear presentations today by anthropologist G. Whitney Athoy and by military security expert Paul Pilar. Even though these presentations are a year old at this point, they still seem fresh today. First, G. Whitney Athoy with a talk entitled, Is There an Afghanistan? Dr. Athoy is a cultural anthropologist who spent nearly four decades working in and thinking about Afghanistan. Most recently, he served as center director and senior fellow at the American Institute of Afghanistan in Kabul. He is also a four-time Fulbright scholar and has made films for National Geographic. As he notes in his talk, one of the reasons he's had such good access to many of the different groups in Afghanistan today is that he knew their grandparents, and memories in Afghanistan, he reports, are very long.
When the invitation came to speak here today, my brief was phrased simply as the Afghans. It got me thinking, does that phrase represent a universally meaningful category? I promise not to use jargon again. Does it mean the same thing, in other words, to people everywhere, the term Afghans? The answer is no. For most of us, it means all the inhabitants of what's come to be called Afghanistan. But for Uzbek farmers on their rain-dependent slopes far above the rich Kunduz River bottomland, Afghan means Pashtun. In particular, the Pashtuns, whose grandfathers pushed their Uzbek counterparts off the floodplain and onto the dry hillsides. Today's Uzbek farmers in northern Afghanistan do not, among themselves, refer to themselves as Afghans. Nor do the Hazaras of Yakalang in Bamiyan, out beyond where the Buddhists used to be, nor do they refer to themselves as Afghans. Their kinfolk were massacred a decade ago by the Pashtun Taliban. And the Hazaras of Yakalang call them Afghans. Then I began thinking about the term Afghanistan and how it started and what it's meant over time. And finally, I wondered about Afghanistan itself and whether it's here to stay. Hence my title, Is There Really an Afghanistan? Two more things at the outset. First, since 1972, I've often been wrong about Afghanistan. Second, I deeply hope that I'm wrong in my fear this morning. My fear is that 21st century Afghanistan, no matter who controls it, or more aptly claims to control it, lacks the DNA of sustainable nation statehood. And further, that since 1978, it has been in a slow motion, agonizing process of collapse and disintegration. Let me develop this troublesome notion in terms of four factors: topography, ethnicity, political origins, and subsequent history. First, I acknowledge the legions of expat Afghanophiles who, following in the footsteps of Louis Dupuy, believe that Afghanistan is a special case, that there's something in the water, that survival over the past three decades implies the three awful decades, implies unified survival indefinitely. As evidence, they cite the truly extraordinary anti-Soviet jihad. And they note, as Ahmad Rashid did yesterday, that even at the worst of times, no separatist movements arose. Afghans, we like to tell ourselves, fought as Afghans, won as Afghans, and stayed Afghans. I'm an Afghanophile, and I used to think this way. And I wish I still did. In fact, the jihad was won not because of patriotic unity, but despite the lack of it, despite the intense and bitter rivalries that occurred between ethnically based groupings of mujahideen. Rhetoric to the contrary, they were fighting and dying much less for their country than for their own lands and families and co-ethnics and, of course, for Islam. As for the absence of separatist movements, no one ethnic region possessed the size and resources to exist on its own. And no matter how bad things got over the ensuing decades, who would want to be annexed by one of the dismal former Soviet stans, or by, forgive me, severely dysfunctional Pakistan, or by Iran, whose harsh treatment of Afghan refugees, even their fellow Shias from the Hazara Jat, was well known? Perhaps there were no serious separatist movements because no serious options existed. Now back to the four main factors that prompt my fear. Next slide, please. Topography is a subset of geography, and as we all know, Afghanistan is landlocked. Not helpful, but not in itself a disqualifier for nation statehood. Consider Switzerland, to which some of the visionary or delusional planners of the new Afghanistan like to point. The problem is not geographical, it's more precisely topographical. The huge Hindu Kush mountain range running down from northeast to southwest and dividing the country smack dab down the middle. In fact, it is these mountains, not the Oxus River or the Indus River, that constitute the true geostrategic division between Central Asia and the Indian subcontinent. It's the Hindu Kush. Note that while rivers look nicely precise on maps and thus appeal to outsider setters of borders, the same people traditionally live on both sides of rivers, and all it takes to cross is a small boat. Mountains like the Hindu Kush are far more formidable impediments to people and to weather. Ask Alexander, ask the Soviets, ask the annual monsoon. Kabul and Kandahar face towards fertile India. Kunduz and Mazar towards the deserts of Central Asia. Not until 1964 did an all-weather road cross the Hindu Kush at 11,000 feet. Back then, and more so today, the Salang Pass is closed by snow several years every winter. 150 people died on that road in an avalanche last week. So there's a north and a south, and they're very, very different, climatically, ethnically, culturally, one could almost say temperamentally. There's also a west, where the Hindu Kush dwindle into flat plains. The ancient city of Herat, located on these flat lands, faces westward and belongs to an area traditionally called Khorasan, a term which refers to sunrise. Sunrise from whose perspective? From the perspective of Persia, currently called Iran, for which Herat is naturally and formerly its eastern frontier. Perhaps its once and future eastern frontier. So topography argues that Afghanistan, far from being a unit unto itself, actually consists of three distinct frontier regions. The eastern fringe of Persia, the northwestern fringe of India, and the southern fringe of Central Asia. A recent National Geographic exhibit of so-called Afghan antiquities proposed that this threefold fringe quality gives all Afghans something in common and somehow unifies them. I find this argument well-intended and utterly nonsensical. Now to ethnicity, and the next slide, please. Yeah. Many of you know the ethnic litany, but let me at least list and place the main groups. Certainly the most numerous are the Pashtuns, who inhabit a broad horizontal swath from below Herat in the west to below and beyond Kabul in the south and the east. When combined numerically with their brethren in northwestern Pakistan, they constitute the world's second largest after the Kurds, ethnic nation without its own state. Unless you're an Afghan Pashtun and you believe, as many of them do, that all Afghanistan belongs to you. There is some linguistic and historical ground for that belief. Afghan and Pashtun as words were originally synonymous and still are, as I've indicated, in the mouths of some non-Pashtuns. And modern Afghanistan dates its founding to the exploits of a Pashtun princeling in 1747. Most neutral demographers hold that Pashtuns represent a low 40-something percent plurality in Afghanistan. Most Pashtuns of my acquaintance, from cabinet ministers to poppy growers, claim at least 60%. In their attitude towards the other groups, they resemble the Prussians of 19th century Germany or the Serbs of 20th century Yugoslavia. Pashtuns have ruled Afghanistan, as far as anybody's ever ruled it, for all but two brief periods in its 263-year history. The royal family was ancestrally Pashtun, albeit Persian-speaking. The Taliban are aggressively and assertively Pashtun. And so the wise men at Bonn, 2001, decided that whatever new leader would have to follow suit, but hoped for a somewhat detribalized Pashtun. Hence that young fellow with nice clothes and good manners that we'd all gotten to know in the drawing rooms of Peshawar and Islamabad. Hence Hamid Karzai. Trouble is, heartland Pashtun society remains well and truly tribal. And Pashtuns who act too detribalized run a risk. The eminent Norwegian anthropologist Fredrik Barth notes that Pashtun Wali, the so-called Pashtun Code, includes a refusal to submit oneself to any form of supra-tribal authority, in particular to government. Government means taxes and census and conscription, all of them anathema to a traditional Pashtun. Once involved with government, Barth says, a Pashtun's cultural authenticity is called into question. Karzai was expected to deliver his Pashtun kinsmen. It hasn't happened, and Barth's observation may explain why not. If he's correct, the whole concept of a Pashtun state becomes an oxymoron. The other main ethnic groups, as you know, include Tajiks, Persian-speaking Indo-European, Hazaras, Persian-speaking Mongol descendant, Uzbeks and Turkomans, Turkic-speaking from East Central Asia, and a catch-all category of Eastern mountaineers, now called Nuristanis, whose language has changed spectacularly from valley to valley. These various non-Pashtun groups differ among themselves, but they share two things. First, a deep-seated, if often hidden, resentment of Pashtun hegemony. I well recall the shock of this recognition. At the embassy where I worked in the 1970s, the early 1970s, it's a closely guarded secret, not on your bios there, that I was once an American diplomat, closely guarded for good reason. At the embassy in the early 1970s, nobody ever spoke about ethnicity. It was, so the Afghan government officials told us, and so we believed, a quaint and outdated, innocuous issue. Then in 1973, as some of you know, I committed career suicide by quitting the Foreign Service in favor of grad school anthropology. 3 years later, with my coursework completed, I was back in Afghanistan and living in a northern village, and realizing to my astonishment that ethnicity, far from being past history, was the name of the game in all spheres of local life. And furthermore, that this game was rigged so that Pashtuns invariably won. The best land, the best water, the choice business locations in town, the fewest hassles from corrupt police. The governor, a Pashtun from Kandahar, a good friend, took me into his confidence and showed me a map with several villages in Kunduz along the river bottom with the same name, Nalkel. Nalkel has to do with transport and conveyance. The idea has to do with moving things. The Nalkel villages, all on rich bottom river, river bottom land, were peopled by Pashtuns who'd been moved north from their southern homeland by the Pashtun government in Kabul. Their mission, to convey Pashtunism, to make Afghanistan Pashtun in name as well as in fact. In fact as well as in name, excuse me, in fact as well as in name. The other ethnicities had to sit and take it and hate it until the onset of chaos in 1978. Thereafter, each of them, in various combinations and subdivisions, reasserted a measure of long-lost autonomy. The Pashtun Taliban took it back from them in the late 1990s, but then came 9/11 and the miracle of our arrival and the non-Pashtuns' subsequent reassertion. They are not about to get bossed around again, except perhaps by their own ethnic bosses, who we tend to call warlords, in part because our perspective, fashioned in Peshawar and Kabul, remains more Pashtun-centric than we realize. The second point in common among non-Pashtun groups is that none of them is truly tribal any longer. Tribal is an oft misused term. It does not mean wild or savage or primitive or even uncontrollable. Rather, a tribal society, for anthropologists, a tribal society is one whose relationships, including political relationships, are structured by kinship. Much of Pashtun society in the South is authentically tribal in that sense. But in the North, there's been more mixing of people and more experience over time with government. And so, rather than a tribal society, the non-Pashtun areas display what could be called proto-civil society, suspicious of government, but not viscerally opposed to it. Note that our current troubles are not really with non-Pashtuns and not really in the North, except in those areas peopled by Nalkel Pashtuns, sympathetic to their Taliban kinsmen. Now a bit of history. Afghan political historians maintain the current nation state began as a Pashtun enterprise in mid-18th century Kandahar. Pashtun forces under a vigorous young leader or warlord named Ahmad Shah Durrani created a short-lived empire that reached across the mountains up north, reached west beyond Herat, and east to Kabul, Peshawar, and even what is now northern India. And yet, as the great medieval sociologist Ibn Khaldun illustrates, Muslim dynasties tend to lose their vigor and unity within three generations. After the princeling's death, his capital was moved to more cosmopolitan Kabul, and his conquests were squandered as descendants occupied themselves in vicious palace struggles. What was left of Afghanistan, a term first concocted in the early 19th century by the British, would likely have disintegrated completely had it not been for the advent of superpower politics and the great game. As their 19th century imperial borders crept ominously closer in Asia, Tsarist Russia and Victorian Britain tacitly recognized the value of a buffer between them. A weak Afghanistan, topographically fragmented and ethnically contentious, filled the bill. Its current borders, finalized in the 1890s, thus reflect the interests of Moscow and especially London more than those of Kabul. Especially London, because Abdurrahman Khan, the Iron Amir, who ruled from 1880 to 1901, decided to make a deal with the more distant of the two empires, British subsidies in return for British control over foreign affairs. The subsidies allowed Abdurrahman to finance and achieve unprecedented internal control, and Afghanistan was far safer in 1900 than it is in 2010. But this accomplishment came at two costs, and these have haunted Afghanistan ever since. One is the matter of arbitrary borders, such as the well-known 1893 Durand Line, drawn by London to separate Afghanistan from British India, now Pakistan, and to divide the Pashtun people in half. The Afghans hated it, but for the sake of subsidies, had to swallow it. Its consequences now dominate our news. A second cost of Abdurrahman's deal with the British has to do with the precedent of subsidies. But for British money, but for those subsidies, the Iron Amir would have been made of tin foil. Subsequent rulers have extended this pattern of dependence. Buffer state financial handouts and dependence have continued with variations until 1978. Bolsheviks overthrew Tsarists in 1917, and America later replaced Britain as the Western champion east of Suez. No matter. Still weak in itself, Afghanistan remained interposed, precariously but also profitably, between the two giants of the age. Neither the USSR nor the US wanted hot war, and together their tacit agreements maintained Afghanistan's territorial integrity. Soviet rubles and US dollars paid for a modicum of internal security and economic development. Chronically unable to foot its own bills, Afghanistan as a buffer state languished but also survived. That era ended with the Marxist coup of April 1978. Suddenly, Afghanistan went from being a laid-back buffer to a Cold War Soviet proxy. Now, only one side, the Soviet Union, provided the money and offered the guarantees. When those guarantees proved first insufficient and then when they all together disappeared, Afghanistan descended into the maelstrom of conflict from which it is yet to recover. Does it have the political DNA to do so? Well, let's recall that nation states have only recently, since the 1648 Treaty of Westphalia, become humanity's political unit of choice. Before then, at least in Eurasia, we had vaguely demarcated empires and spheres of control. These waxed and waned, came and went. The only enduring socio-political unit was not the artificial city, the artificial state, but the organic city. The city, cities endure. Cities such as Herat. And the truly well-based leader, the leader with the truest sort of support, was someone like Herat's current homeboy, whom we like to call warlord, Ismail Khan. Well, nowadays, some modern nation states, fortunate in their DNA, have a natural purpose. Their sole reason for existence is as a viable instrument for their own people. Take Iceland, admittedly an extreme example in its topographical unity and ethnic homogeneity. Iceland exists, pure and simple, for the sake of Icelanders. No contrived purpose is required. Afghanistan, as currently configured, presents the other extreme, a nation-state with fragmented topography, mutual hostile ethnicities, arbitrary borders established by outsiders, and a continued existence maintained until 1978 by outsiders as a buffer state. What happens to such a feeble outfit when the outsider need for it disappears? Yes, the international community has a stake in existing structures. And yes, stability, as I recall from my brief service, is important to the State Department. But structure and stability do not come cheap in Afghanistan. Who in the long term will hold it together? Who long term will pay its bills? Well, now, Afghanistan's nation-state apparatus is again, at least temporarily, supported by outsiders because of the confrontation between militant Islam and the West. What will happen once this conflict subsides or once its epicenter shifts elsewhere? Does the current bloodshed and hyper-corruption represent merely growing pains of an Afghanistan on the way to eventual success? Or are we witnessing the gradual deterioration and ultimate disappearance of a nation state that, except for the impulse of Pashtun expansionism, never really had a rationale of its own? Could it have been different if different decisions had been made in 2001, 2, and 3? Perhaps so, at least in the short run. Certainly our false premised invasion of Iraq diverted key resources at a time when Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were on the run. Those resources could perhaps have closed the military deal in the short run. In my opinion, a pair of even more consequential mistakes had already been made at the Bonn Conference in December 2001. First, it was decided proudly and unrealistically to make Afghanistan far more government centralized, far, far more than ever before, certainly far more than before the Troubles. Secondly, and stupidly, the pre-conflict monarchy was discarded, shunted aside. And let's take those decisions and make a comparison between Afghanistan, where I worked for so many years, and Spain, where I now live. Afghanistan, at the time of Bonn, had suffered the worst last quarter of the 20th century of any country on earth. Coup, counter-coup, holy war, civil war, material destruction, massive human death and displacement. Now contrast Afghanistan to Spain, which, after Franco's death in 1975, had arguably the world's best end of quarter century. The best end of quarter century. How come? Enormous progress was made on all fronts, thanks to the balance provided by a new Spanish constitution that blended two seemingly opposed initiatives. First, it returned the monarchy as a symbol of national identity. Second, it allowed for unprecedented regional autonomy. Note that exactly the opposite was done to Afghanistan at Bonn. Now it may be too late. The old king, who had far deeper Pashtun support than Karzai, is dead. And Karzai, reelected in a farce and faced with unprecedented levels of corruption, maintains the same doomed centralist facade while negotiating with the Taliban movement that, I believe, has little reason to negotiate. All of what Ahmad Rashid said last night is true. But hey, in the end, we're leaving and they're staying. And they know it. And we have the watches, but they have the time. Why negotiate? Given this shambles, worsening daily, what should U.S. policy be? Should we continue our much ballyhooed efforts to nation build in the name of centralized government? This strategy, rooted in familiar 21st century assumptions, could be called recreate the state. Speaking of the current U.S.-led offensive in Helmand Province, our General McChrystal says, we've got a government in a box, by which he means representatives of the Kabul government. We've got a government in a box ready to roll in. Well, maybe so, but what happens when our troops roll out? Almost certainly the central government officials will roll out shortly afterwards, and the Taliban will roll back in. So much, at least in the Pashtun South, for recreate the state. Which leaves us with what I call bribe the tribe. This other strategy, old-fashioned to the point of archaic, is more or less how the British coped in their day. And it's what we seem now to have announced and maybe even started, despite Karzai's fury, with the Shinwaris, a key tribe of frontier Khilzai Pashtuns. Here's the deal. Our development resources delivered directly to tribal elders with no Kabul officialment, no Kabul officialdom involved, in return for Shinwari agreement to burn the houses of Taliban collaborators. That's what Pashtuns do when they want to make life difficult. They burn their houses. Will the Shinwari stick to this bargain? Even if they do, it won't be a one-time fix. We'll have to do it year after year, and maybe Pashtun tribe by Pashtun tribe, as long as militant Islamist terrorism makes its home in the Pashtun heartland. It could take decades. Would take decades. But compared to what we do now, it would cost fewer American lives, and probably fewer Afghan lives, and maybe even fewer U.S. tax dollars. Bribe the tribe, of course, would not be regarded as directly supportive of the Afghan central government, and thus the Afghan nation state. Indeed, it would seem to undermine these modern era institutions. So I don't necessarily advocate a return to 19th century style politics. But at a minimum, here's what I do recommend. Let's bite the bullet and ask ourselves whether, long term, Afghanistan is going to survive anyway. Whether it has the DNA of enduring nation statehood. I have my doubts. I hope I'm wrong, and I thank you for listening.
That was anthropologist Whitney Atoy on this WERU special featuring selected presentations from the 2010 Camden Conference. Next, we'll hear from Paul Pilar, here introduced by last year's conference moderator, Nicholas Burns.
Paul is going to assess, in essence, how well the United States has done its 8.5-year venture in Afghanistan. Paul is uniquely qualified to do this. He spent 28 years at the senior levels of our intelligence community. He completed his career as the National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia, and he's someone with, I think, almost unrivaled expertise on this part of the world, but also in the dynamics that have produced the insurgencies that we've witnessed. He is currently professor at Georgetown University, and he's director in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown. Paul Pilar, welcome.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon. As another one of those Washington refugees fleeing the snow, I am delighted to be able to come to Maine in February to thaw out and dry out. I'm going to address the rationales and impact of the U.S. military expedition in Afghanistan. And by that, I mean my subject is the fundamental question of why are we there at all, and how did we get there? I'm going to give you a very specific point of view on this. It's going to be a point of view that is sharply focused on U.S. interests, and it's a point of view that is partly shaped by another part of my background, which is as a former counter-terrorist official. So Afghanistan is the topic. 12 years ago was the first direct application of U.S. military force in Afghanistan, a strike with cruise missiles ordered by the Clinton administration against a camp associated with Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda organization in response to that group's attack on two U.S. embassies in Africa. On the morning of the missile strike, I had the task of going to the Capitol and briefing the congressional intelligence committees on the underlying intelligence about al-Qaeda's terrorist activities, what they were doing at that camp and other things in Afghanistan, and what was the nature of their relationship with the Afghan Taliban. After the George W. Bush administration came into office, its focus as far as policy on Afghanistan was concerned was also bin Laden, and specifically how the Taliban might be convinced to end its hospitality for him and his group. The delicacies observed in those days, and in retrospect, doesn't that cruise missile strike seem like a pinprick? Those delicacies were swept aside by the drastic change in the American public mood caused by the terrorist attack in September 2001, after which the United States intervened in what became known as Operation Enduring Freedom in an ongoing Afghan civil war. The intervention quickly succeeded in ousting the Taliban from power over most of Afghanistan and rousted al-Qaeda from its Afghan haven. It is impossible to understand how we got to where we are today without reference to that history, and specifically to the association of Afghanistan in American minds and discourse with terrorism, to the overpowering impact of 9/11 on American emotions and politics, to the disquieting sense that the United States had prematurely turned away from Afghanistan after assisting Mujahideen and pushing the Soviets out during the 1980s, and most of all to the fact that, given our intervention in the fall of 2001, we were already there. Another important bit of politics and history is the Bush administration's expedition in Iraq, which our current president, to his credit in my judgment, opposed from the beginning. This made Afghanistan, in contrast, the so-called good war, and the theater in which President Obama and his administration and his party would demonstrate their counter-terrorist bona fides and ward off their opponents' incessant efforts to portray them as wimps on national security. This historical and political context is what makes waging a costly counterinsurgency in Afghanistan comprehensible. It cannot be comprehended in terms of a dispassionate analysis of U.S. national interests. The single most consistently cited rationale for the counterinsurgency in Afghanistan, and you saw it as the core goal in one of Larry's slides representing official U.S. policy for why we're there, is that it is a key part of the fight against al-Qaeda and a means of protecting the American people against terrorism by preventing al-Qaeda from reestablishing the sort of safe haven it had in Afghanistan at the time of 9/11. Now, the first problem with that is al-Qaeda isn't even in Afghanistan, except National Security Advisor Jones tells us, for fewer than 100 members. So we have adopted as a kind of surrogate enemy the Afghan Taliban. The surrogacy might seem to make sense given that the Taliban clearly have shared an extreme ideology and a past close alliance with al-Qaeda. But the Taliban are not a transnational terrorist group. Their goals are not bin Laden's goals. They are one of the most insular bands ever to get international attention. They care about the political and social order in Afghanistan. They do not care about the United States, except insofar as the United States gets in the way of their aspirations for the internal ordering of Afghanistan. Afghans in general, by the way, despite how much we have come to associate their country with international terrorism, are actually relatively scarce in the ranks of international terrorists, notwithstanding the occasional exception, such as Najibullah Zassi, the young man who became radicalized, not in some camp in South Asia, but during his days selling coffee and pastries from a cart in Lower Manhattan. If the Taliban were to return to power over most of Afghanistan, they would, in my judgment, see little or no advantage in once again hosting a significant presence of bin Laden's al-Qaeda. Their previous playing of host, after all, led directly after 9/11 to the biggest setback the Taliban ever suffered. Bin Laden and his partner, Ayman al-Zawahiri, also would see little advantage in restoring the previous arrangement. They have successfully stayed hidden in northwest Pakistan for nearly a decade now, and any attempt to rebuild anything like what al-Qaeda previously had in Afghanistan would quickly expose the group, not just to pinpricks this time, but instead to the sort of uninhibited U.S. firepower that American public outrage after 9/11 unleashed, and which would still be in play even if U.S. troops were not on the ground. And even if, despite this disincentive, al-Qaeda were to try to rebuild something like that earlier presence, it would make little difference to the terrorist threat that confronts Americans. The policy issue regarding Afghanistan is not whether terrorist groups make use of safe havens, if available. They do. The issue is not even whether the use of such a haven helps the group. It does. The issue instead is whether the use of this haven by this group would make it so much more of a threat, over and above the threat that it would pose anyway, to warrant the expenditure of blood and treasure required by a counterinsurgency in Afghanistan. One consideration I already mentioned, the lack of attractiveness of an Afghan haven relative to the one in northwest Pakistan that bin Laden's group already enjoys, suggests that it does not. Another consideration is the availability of other possible havens, should the group need and want one, such as Yemen, Somalia. Those are the ones that are most often mentioned. There's no shortage of such places, and the United States clearly does not have the resources to try to pacify them all. Yet another consideration is that, as 9/11 itself demonstrated, most of the preparations for terrorist attacks that most endanger Americans take place not in territorial havens, but instead in scattered locations elsewhere, chiefly in the West. In the case of 9/11, it was in Spain, in Germany, mostly right here in the United States. Other assets of a group, in particular, ideological appeal and a ready supply of already radicalized recruits, is much more important than a piece of acreage. Still another consideration is that the Sunni Salafi terrorist threat that has become increasingly diffuse in a way that lessens any organizational reliance on a particular command structure in South Asia. A reminder of this was that attempted bombing on Christmas Day of a Detroit-bound airliner, which received so much attention. The would-be bomber was a Nigerian, radicalized while a student in the United Kingdom, further influenced by an extremist imam in Yemen who had spent half his life in the United States. And so far as we know, the group that outfitted Abdul Muttalib with his explosive underwear, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, was not taking orders from anyone hiding in the hinterland of South Asia. This was another one of those groups that has adopted the Al-Qaeda brand name, but is not being directed or ordered or financed by bin Laden and Zawahiri. The operation had nothing to do with Afghanistan. Now, as for the counterinsurgency itself, Larry Goodson has expertly covered most of this, and I'm just going to make the following three points. That's the famous manual, by the way. One is to express confidence in our commanders and the brave troops under their command that they're going to make the best of a very difficult situation. The second is that the situation is very difficult indeed. In ways that ought to make us pessimistic against the standards of established counterinsurgency doctrine. One of the reasons is that weakness of the national DNA that Whitney Ezoy described so expertly this morning. Another is, and we've seen numerous references to this, the corruption and wide perception of illegitimacy on the part of the central government. Another is that the forces available may simply be not sufficient, and that was a question addressed earlier to Larry, and I'd agree with his answer, given the magnitude of the task. The time available is very likely to be insufficient, given the administration's timetable of beginning to ramp down the U.S. presence barely a year after it was ramped up. Even if our resourceful forces manage, and this is my third basic point about the counterinsurgency, manage despite these challenges to stabilize most of Afghanistan, this will buy the American people little or nothing in the way of increased security. And this is for the reasons I already mentioned with regard to safe havens and what they mean. I'll add one more reason, which is that even if General McChrystal's strategy succeeds completely, that will mean stabilizing and securing only part of Afghanistan, leaving ample room for someone to establish a safe haven if that's what we're really worried about. And General McChrystal's strategy, going back to that leaked document, makes this quite clear. Meanwhile, the counterproductive aspects of applying U.S. military power in Afghanistan also have become all too apparent. Foreign military occupation has helped to unite, motivate, and win support for the disparate elements that we have come to label the Afghan Taliban. The occupation and inevitable collateral damage and civilian casualties have drained much of what had been, remarkably so for a predominantly Muslim country, a reservoir of goodwill toward the United States, and have stimulated more Afghans to take up arms against coalition forces. We read about such incidents week after week. The most recent one in the March offensive, we heard about about a week ago, about a dozen people killed when there was an errant missile, most of them women and children. One of the results has been seen in some public opinion polls. This is the product of a consortium of news organizations that have asked the basic questions of favorable or unfavorable attitudes toward the United States at various intervals. The trend's pretty clear. I should hasten to add that the same consortium did come out with a further result just in the last fortnight that didn't make it onto this slide, which shows a slight uptick, which is very encouraging. But the trend, as I say, is not. Many of those who have joined the fight against U.S. and allied forces in Afghanistan really have no sympathy for the Taliban's ideology and do not even warrant the label Taliban. They are best described as angry and frustrated Afghans. The weakness of the rationale for pressing the fight in Afghanistan has led many supporters of that fight to say, well, our real concern is next door in Pakistan. There's a lot of commentary which embodies visions of mad mullahs getting their hands on those Pakistani nuclear weapons. The visions get tossed about, but without any explanation of exactly how events in Afghanistan would influence the future of Pakistan. Generally, instability can spill over a border like this for one of two reasons. Either it brings more resources to bear on the conflict in the second country, or it provides a base of operations, another kind of safe haven. Well, in this case, neither of those, in my analysis, seems to be, would be a major factor or even a significant one in governing events in Pakistan. A Taliban victory in Afghanistan would not bring any significant new resources to bear on the conflict in Pakistan, which has a population 5 times as large and an economy 10 times as large as Afghanistan. Nor would it offer Pakistani militants a safe haven any more attractive or useful than the one they already have in Pakistan's own federally administered tribal areas, the brownish area on the map. Pakistani officials themselves offer what might be the most authoritative take on how, if at all, U.S. military operations in Afghanistan affect security challenges within their own country, particularly as it relates to the Pakistani Taliban, as well as those other sources of trouble and mischief we heard about earlier, away from the Fatah and into the settled areas. The Pakistanis have expressed concern that to the degree those operations, U.S. military operations in Afghanistan, are successful, they will merely push militants across the Durand line, just as bin Laden and his colleagues were pushed across 8 years ago. And another factor is that the unpopularity among most Pakistanis of just about any U.S. military operation in the nearby region also limits Islamabad's political ability to cooperate with the United States in pursuing Washington's objectives, including counter-terrorist objectives, or at least to be seen doing so, which, if nothing else, is an inhibition and a complication. Then there is what Pakistani officials do not acknowledge, their continued relationship with the Afghan Taliban, which they distinguish from the Pakistani Taliban and see not as a threat, but instead as an asset and a form of insurance against the political uncertainty of Afghanistan itself. And as we've heard in previous talks, this is in their context, Afghanistan, that it is part of their strategic depth in confronting India. And this presents perhaps the ultimate irony of the United States war in Afghanistan, that the government we are supposedly trying to save from spreading instability, that is to say, the status quo in Pakistan, is itself doing business with the principal enemy we are fighting. And by the way, my observations about the most recent capture of this Afghan Taliban leader that was reported a couple of weeks ago conform pretty much with what Ahmed Rashid said last night in his commenting on that capture. There's one more rationale one often hears for pursuing the counterinsurgency, and that is that to back down from our existing commitment there, precisely because it is an existing commitment, and no matter how peripheral it might otherwise be to core U.S. interests, that this would severely damage U.S. credibility, disillusioning our friends and encouraging our adversaries. This, I might observe, is, and it's somewhat pertinent to the last question that was posed to Larry in the last hour, this is strikingly reminiscent of the chief rationale for the war in which I served as an Army officer, namely the one in Vietnam. The underlying assumption was as unexamined and as invalid then as it is now. Look at the way we regard, or we would regard, some other government in pulling back from either a losing hand or proposition, or pulling back from costly endeavors that were not vital for our core interest. Would we question that same government's determination to stand up for things that were important to it and did have to do with its core interest in the future? No, of course we wouldn't. We would consider each interest on its own. And that's not the way other governments interpret our behavior either. It's simply not the way Either we would assess the willingness of other governments to stand up for the most important interest. It's not how others assess ours. And I would commend some academic research on this, by the way, by Professor Daryl Press of Dartmouth, particularly in a book, if I remember the title, called Calculating Credibility. Let me close on this thought. One of the most admirable qualities of Americans is their determination to see their undertakings, especially foreign wars, through to successful achievement of American goals, whatever may have been the reason for positing those goals. We are seeing some of that admirable quality today in Afghanistan and in the way that our troops there are carrying the fight forward, which admittedly makes the kinds of downbeat observations you're getting from me rather depressing. And they also don't advance Nick Burns' stated objective of making us feel better by Sunday afternoon. But that is my honest assessment. And Mr. Chairman, I yield back the remainder of my time and look forward to questions.
That was Paul Pilar speaking at last year's Camden Conference. This year's Camden Conference will run from February 18th to 20th. The theme is The Challenges of Asia. The conference will originate at the Camden Opera House and will be simulcast at several locations, including the Strand Theatre in Rockland, the Hutchinson Centre in Belfast, and the Grand in Ellsworth. For more information about the conference, go to www.camdenconference.org. Thanks for listening to this WERU special report. If you missed any of it, it will be archived and available on the WERU website at www.weru.org.